This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
By having this group, this network of institutions that collaborated together, presented elements of the project together, it would be a way of having a discussion across these different sites about the politics of displacement and dispossession in general. Okay. So just so that you have a quick sense of the project, Memory Trace, which is presented on the ground floor here, consists of a series of photographs of ruins, landscapes, and portraits. Portraits of people who lived in the villages that were evacuated and mostly destroyed during the 48 war and were either displaced by the war or forced into refugee camps. The middle section, Desert Bloom, takes its title, of course, from Ben-Gurion's famous claim that Israel would make the desert bloom. And these are the aerial photographs that are on the first floor. These are photographs that document what actually has been blooming in the desert. Mining operations, forestation projects, destruction and evacuation of Bedouin villages, settlements, etc., and is one of the, I think, a very strong, and these are images that I don't think people have seen very much. The third section, Independence Nakba, is not being shown here. These are a series of 65 diptychs, portraits of people from both sides of the separation wall. What's kind of extraordinary about them is that they're the 65 portraits, the diptychs, representing people from both sides of the wall are presented chronologically by age. So they start with a pair of one-year-olds, two-year-olds, three-year-olds, etc. 65 portraits, one portrait from each year from 1948 to 2013. And I think what's extraordinary about the diptychs, you won't have a chance to see them here unless you look at the book that Jack has suggested you could review, is that when you're looking at the diptychs, it's impossible to look at both portraits at the same time equally. So there's a way in which the portraits stage part of the problem. Your eye has to decide and choose who it's going to privilege at any given moment. The other section, Al-Raqib, which is showing in the lower level of Mamal, has to do with, it includes materials, photographs, a video linked to the village Al-Raqib, which has been built and demolished over 100 times since 2010. Now, all of these sections together, I think, present, I mean, the way in which I like to think about them is that they're a training manual on how to read image historically, and in particular, how to read images historically at a moment of danger. And I think that one of the things that Fazl has always done is encouraged us to learn how to read by forcing us to read images in relation to one another. I mean, one of the things that I think is difficult but complicated about this series, this Erasure Trilogy, is that it's not just that as you look at one of the volumes, one of the sections, that you have to think about the images in relation to one another. That's one thing that you have to do, of course. But you have to start thinking about the images in relation to the images that are other parts of the project, so that you have to read the images syntactically across the different elements or let's say, the volumes, but also sections of the project. This is a way of telling us that memories never appear alone, right? That memories always have to appear in a series, and that in fact, none of the images that he has produced can be read in isolation from one another. So that if you're looking at any one of the images, one of the things you have to do is contextualize that image, not only in relation to the history that is sealed within it, but also in relation to all of the other images within that series, but also within every one of the series that belong to the project. One of the things that I thought I would do, and I just close with this because I want to actually have the discussion with our panelists, is that you know, if you look at the project, you'll see that one of the things that Fazl does is he at different moments punctuates the portraits, the images, the landscapes, the ruins, with poems by Mahmoud Darwish, the Palestinian poet. And I think that what I wanted to do is, in closing, is just recall a particular prose poem that Darwish wrote, which is called The Humor of Eternity. And in this prose poem, one of the things that he does is he describes the death of a friend, He describes the death of a friend who had died in Paris. His friend gets buried in Paris. But because he gets buried in Paris, which is a city, let's say, he gets buried surrounded by trees and birds and cafes and people walking in the streets. There's a way, he says, in which the person who dies and is buried here is not only not alone, but one can almost imagine that he or she remains sleeping in some way, because there's still a relation to all the life that is around this person. He compares that to someone who dies in the desert. And he says that somebody who dies in the desert is not surrounded by cafes, theaters, people walking in the streets, birds, etc. So that the person who dies in the desert and who's buried in the desert is less able to imagine, or we're less able to imagine, that they're only sleeping. And in fact, that we have to confront the death of that person more directly, precisely because of the isolation. And what he does is he says that what the people who bury these people who die in the desert put photographs on the graves, not just to memorialize the person, not just to have us remember this person, but also to teach history how to read. And I've always been struck by this, because I think, as I was saying, that I think one of the amazing things about Fazel's photographs is that they invite us to learn how to read historically. But this poem is not just saying that we need to learn how to read historically, it's also saying that this activity of putting photographs next to memorials, next to ruins, next to people who are dead, but with whom we want to retain a relation, even if only through memory, that these people are able to do that mostly through the activity of putting these photographs there. So one of the things that he seems to suggest is that photography is a privileged medium for permitting us to keep the memory of the dead alive. And I think what I want to say is that I think one of the most precious gifts that I've always thought that Fazel's photographs give us is not simply the opportunity to remember what has vanished, but which still has left its traces that we are to read as traces, but is also this invitation, as I say, to learn to read historically in moments of danger. And I think that one of the things that the photographs tell us is that we not only are looking at a history that belongs to a history of danger, but that in fact we still live in this moment of danger. And what I'm going to do now is just ask Fazel to say a few words about the project, how it was generated, what he thinks about it, perhaps. And then we'll go in sequence through the three speakers, and then we'll open it up. Okay? Thank you.
Okay, stereo. Firstly, I'd just like to thank my friends Eduardo and Aaron for spending 2 years essentially traveling with me and thinking about a means by which to read these various projects in an effective way, and to, in some way, hopefully at least add to or invite a conversation. And for me, it was especially important that we find a means by which to bring the work back to the place where it was made. For me personally, it's rather essential to be in the various communities here, and hopefully also to open the work or myself up to a degree of deeper thought or criticism, perhaps, of what I've been thinking about, what I've seen. And I'm loath to say too much, because I don't want to explain in a manner that might hamper my friends from reading these images, because I love the notion that it's an educative process for me as well. My experience of making these images, and when I see them before me, I have a very particular sense of what that image meant. And what it holds for me. But I love when people read them for me and bring their own sense of the world to bear upon that which they're seeing. We did this very effectively, I think, in New York a few months ago, and Amira Haas is here. She was generous enough to be with us that night. But just very briefly, I mean, I was invited here in 2010. I'm American, born and raised in the States, in New York, and have no familial ties to this region at all. At the outset, since it was for a longer period, and it was a notion of 12 artists spending 6 to 8 months in the region and producing a book and a traveling exhibition, I was a little bit concerned about being instrumentalized. My name, Fazl Ilahi Sheikh, might imply a certain set of allegiances, and I knew that the trajectory of my own work had always been very open to different positions, different religious perspectives, making work across gender. I didn't want to be limited in that sense. But I did realize that this was perhaps the only opportunity I would ever have to see this place with such permission and openness. And so I was somehow agreed to make a series of trips initially, not accepting this sort of compact, whatever it might be called. And on the third trip, I had been interviewing, because the odd notion of being a person like me is that you can move with fluidity between one community and another. And I was curious, of course, as a primer, to learn about 1948, the start of the state, and to interview combatants on both sides of the divide. And I remember interviewing with my friend here, Talia, one of the Israeli combatants in Tel Aviv, and he spoke of the area in which he had been fighting. But just before he spoke of that, he talked about having been raised in a community wherein they were speaking one another's languages, and that he had been raised also speaking Arabic, and that this rupture of 48 had riven between these communities such a divide that is clearly almost irreparable. And he offered to take us to the place that he had battle. We didn't go with him, but I started to visit the sites that had been evacuated during the war, and I realized that this really basic, I mean, Tamar and Jack will know that well enough for themselves, that it's a very basic starting point here. But for me, it was important to start somewhere and to begin to understand for myself the way things function, to get my bearings, in a sense. And I soon realized, actually, what was interesting to me was not only visiting these sites, but was moving across the divide to find the people who were born and raised in those places could no longer visit them, meaning that the artist becomes a kind of conduit between the place left behind and the place they now inhabit, either in an Arab-Israeli town or in the refugee communities. And for me, that was heartening because it was instructive, basically as though a student, you know, moving across from one place to the next, remaining open to what people would instruct about the places that I was seeing. And when one sees an exhibition like that, you look at it and you think that it has, that there's a clear trajectory set out from the start, but it isn't in my case. It was just fumbling through one body of work. 48 soon led to work in the South, which was prompted by an experience I had one afternoon. I'll just tell you very briefly, because it was in Al Arakib, the basement here. We've done a little piece about that. I was invited to visit with the community there, and we were sitting in one of the protest tents out in an area that had only months prior been the center of the village. And Sayyah al-Turi told us about the morning in which the village had been razed to the ground and the families evacuated from the land. There was a small group that continued to live within the perimeter of the cemetery. And sitting there within the sort of embrace of the community and under this tent, looking out across actually not only plowed land, the houses being razed, having been razed to the ground, now they were preparing, the JNF was preparing for the Ambassador Forest to be planted. In 20 years you would visit that same space, and it would be much like the areas which I visited and tried to find the remnants of villages from 48. And though I had never photographed from the plane, it seemed to me immediately essential to go aloft, to see that place within the broader context of the desert and try to figure out what the clues the desert had to offer from above meant. And so that first flight gave me a sense, in a way, of challenging, as Eduardo said, or rendering inquiries about what it had meant to make the desert bloom, this invocation by Ben-Gurion and before, and the way in which the desert itself has been transformed during the intervening years between 48 and today. And in particular, the way in which different communities orient themselves towards the desert. Do they live in an astute way, aware of the signs of the desert and the way in which they need to modify their lives to live in harmony with the space? Or do they decide to, in a way, make the space habitable along a different set of priority rules? So essentially what we have in the building here are various projects that are closely connected, woven together, one growing onto the next. And so I'm just delighted and thankful that Aaron, Tamer, and Jack will read some of these images, and then we can hopefully have a conversation. Thank you.
Thank Jack and Jumana and Aline for your extraordinary kindness to us, for your openness to collaboration, and for all that you do. I want to begin with an excerpt from Mahmoud Darwish's The House's Casualty in A River Dies of Thirst. We've been using this short passage kind of alongside our curatorial language for this exhibition as it's moved through different venues, so I want to share it with you tonight. In each thing there is a being in pain, a memory of fingers, a scent, an image, and houses are killed just like their inhabitants. And the memory of things is killed, stone, wood, glass, iron, cement are scattered in broken fragments like living beings. All these things are a memory of the people who no longer have them, and of the objects that no longer have the people. Destroyed in a minute, our things die like us, but they aren't buried with us. I'd like to speak to Fazal Sheikh's photograph of Deir Rafat, an Arab village in the Jerusalem district here. This photograph depicts the rubble of former houses and stone terraces, which were completely destroyed in September 1948, when they were blown up by the Harel Brigade of the Israeli Defense Forces. This photograph is ostensibly silent, though Darwish's poem helps us to recognize these stones as interwoven with memory, with meaning, and with voice. They bear witness to the fragments of what was once a community, but also the rupture and violence inherent in displacement and in dispossession. To destroy a person's objects, to destroy a person's home, is to destroy their sense of self, their sense of community. The memory of this erasure, the pain caused by this erasure, but also the extraordinary resilience of memory in the face of erasure, are a few of the many things this photograph depicts for me. There are many ways to silence this photograph. A few months ago in Philadelphia, while this photograph, as well as the larger exhibition, was on display, a panel of journalists and educators from the New York Times and area academic and cultural institutions gathered and in their discussion dismissed it as a fabrication. Referencing Munir's testimony in particular, and I encourage you before you leave tonight to read Munir's testimony on the ground floor. One remarked that it was an amateurish form of history making, likely invented by Fazal himself as a form of propaganda. It would be so easy to disregard these comments as absurd were they not uttered in a public setting in front of students and others, and had they not constituted a further act of erasure, one that sought to dismiss and denigrate the pain of the individuals whose lives and stories are documented in this project. Such comments as those are also symptomatic of a larger tendency today, which is to not speak about 1948 at all. Fazal's project reminds us that we need to remain committed to speaking about what is not allowed, which in this case means speaking about 1948 all these years after. We must speak about it whether we come from here or there, and whether we feel we have a right to speak or not. In Representations of the Intellectual, Edward Said speaks about how we must each, in fact, develop this vocation for the art of representing, for talking, for writing, for publicly engaging in around vulnerable issues and vulnerable communities, even at the risk of being exiled from these communities, from other communities, and from the institutions of which we're a part. At SLOT, an institution in Philadelphia, where I'm the director and Eduardo is a curator, we felt it was essential, after having undertaken various events and publications over the years around these issues, around these matters, to commit ourselves to continual public programming around this history of dispossession, but also the occupation more generally. So for the last year, this has been our entire focus. Like Edward Said's definition of the intellectual, we believe that institutions should be founded upon this idea of talking about what is difficult to talk about enabling the conversations that need to happen, about creating the forums that enable others, perhaps others that are unable or unwilling to construct these forums, to participate in them. Over the past months, as Eduardo and Fazal have mentioned, a decentralized network of various institutions have come together to work with us around this exhibition, beginning in Philadelphia, then in New York, and now here. Throughout, it's become apparent to me just how difficult this project is for institutions to engage, be they small organizations or large museums. This project has the potential to disturb an institution's relation to their funders and to their publics, but also how that institution interprets its own mission and its own priorities. In New York, moreover, the project was received with near total silence by the press. As with this photograph of Deir Rafat, this supposed silence can also be read as a form of resistance to the project and to the histories it seeks to document. The project also asks a great deal of you, for what's being presented is not simply a series of photographs, but actual lives and testimonies. Eduardo has previously written about and earlier remarked about relation in Fazal's work and the way in which his photographs can never be read in isolation because they're always to be understood in relationship to each other. I think this project asks each of us to find our own relation to the lives and historical events that are exhibited in this photograph and in all of those below. And so I want to encourage each of you to construct your own relation to these photographs and these memories, and in so doing, to counter the various forms of erasure that Fazal is helping each of us to learn how to resist.
I was looking at these photographs, and I was trying to read through them as, of course, Aaron had requested. And of course, I've had this discussion with E.L. Weissman. And one thing that really captured my imagination is his reading of how the landscape in these photographs, and it was really amazing as Fazal was saying, that he decided that he's going up in a plane and taking these aerial photographs. So eventually the reading becomes of a surface that carries this history, and how that surface becomes a sort of a photographic print. Especially, I don't know, amongst you, especially those who have developed photographs in a lab can understand what I'm saying. So these surfaces reveal, as the photograph in a lab reveals whatever was shot, but this is a kind of almost a history embedded in them. So the actual act of revelation has taken years and years. And as you look more into these photographs, you see that you have darker spots, lighter spots, shapes, circles, rectangles, squares, whatever. And you realize the only thing that had made this some fade away, some more stronger in color, is the actual time. And when I discussed this with Eyal, he said to me, and Fazal, you can correct me, that they've used actually this in the court to prove that this settlement was here for a long period of time, and the actual act of erasure or the actual act of displacement that the Israeli forces were trying to do on the people, the inhabitants of that area, was actually not working. And so people were moved from one place, and then the next year or whatever, I don't know how long it took, so they came back and rebuilt their houses and their yards and everything, and raised their crops and of course moved their cattle and sheep and those the stains that they left, and the excrement from the sheep and all these human and animal processes have left their mark. So Eyal was telling me that this was actually something that they've used in the court of law to ascertain the existence of these and show that this act of erasure, of destroying their houses time after time after time, and as Eduardo said, that they've destroyed the Araqib over 100 times, and still the presence was there. And of course, in some of them, you can see the cemetery, which was not really touched, but in any way, all the settlement around the cemetery was somehow marked in these prints and these photographs. So in my mind, this had opened up a whole new horizon of my understanding of what photography is and what is this medium and how it can be utilized and how how it is not necessary to deal with cameras and paper and photographic paper and all these materials to enable to reveal something or present something. So my mind took me to light and took me to the whole notion of investigating light as the source that that brings about this revelation and allows us to see things. Of course, I was totally also taken by the project, and I'm not really here referring to the picture, the photograph. I was totally taken by the project because since more than 2 years, I've been wanting to do something about the Nakba. Not that in 2 years we'll have a very special anniversary. I think every day should be a day of commemorating the Nakba. But because it is something that is so present, it is something that has affected Palestinians in every way you can imagine. So who we are, how we act, why we're here, why we do this, and why this is happening to us is all because of that Nakba. And I remember in a very early discussion I had with a dear friend who's here amongst us, Daphna, I was always troubled with the whole peace negotiations and the Oslo Accords, of course, because I said this should start with an apology. This should start with a recognition from the Israelis that, they've committed this this genocide. They've deported two-thirds of the population. They've done this, and they recognize it now, and they want to start a new page. And now we can talk about peace, and now we can talk about whatever we want to talk about. But since that wasn't the actual basis of that whole, you know, kind of meeting or encounter, and eventually that led to a peace deal or the Oslo Accords, obviously that failed, and everybody kind of saw that. So that's what on my mind, you know, kind of looking at Fozzo's photograph.
Shukran. Yes, that's mine. Okay. Assalamu alaikum. I'm not a photographer, and I'm not into. I am into photography, like just to see things exciting. But I was always jealous, and I always tell my friends that, especially in hip hop and rap, I'm a rap artist, and we always have to say what we want to deliver the message. We need at least 200, 300 words, and I'm always jealous of photographers because they can capture it in. So first of all, when Eduardo approached me, I was the first thing I did is just going through the photos and just, you know, zooming in and zooming out and hating you because I'm jealous. I'm kidding. So I'm very honored to be part of it. Actually, I apologize. I won't have any descriptions about angles and lights. I just like it, and that's. I think that's the most important thing. Sometimes I find that I can't tell big words about the photos, but I just like it, and that's enough for me. But this specific one took me back to when I was young. I was born in Lid. Lid is an Israeli city nowadays. And for at least 50, 100 years from now. It just took me back because I have to stand up. When I was young, there was garbage up to here. So for us to go in, we had to like come from this place and just crawl inside because it was full of garbage. And it was, there's a lot of memories. There's a lot of secrets. It's like the Nevada desert where the mobsters bury things. So this is where you bury everything in this place. I just like to collect three memories. Some of them might be nasty, but it's okay. Near that place, there's a football game, a football playground. Can malab football, or how do you say it in Arabic? Malab kadur regel. So we hek bara hek al-arabi taitna ihna. So we used to play soccer all the time, and one of my first memories is, as I said, everything you do it in this place. If you want to hide something, you do it in this place. It's like the Italian mafia in Nevada, as I said. So my first memory is we were playing soccer next to this place, and there come this handsome guy. He looks exactly like you, very handsome. And he has earrings, and he asks in Hebrew, excuse me, where? How can I get to certain place? And my friends stopped the game, and they're like, yeah, you go there and there. And then he noticed their accent, and he said, oh, into Arab. And they told him, are you an Arab? Because he had an earring and a long hair. And then they noticed that he's an Arab, and they're like, so you are an Arab too? And there's like, oh, we thought you were a Jew, so we told you to go there. But it's get dramatic, believe me. It's not, he wishes he was a Jew. So it's here. So they took him there, and the last thing I remember is him running with his ear bloody because they teared his earrings, because its earrings are gay. So that was my first, am I ruining your evening? I will make it up to you. I will make it up later. That's my style. I take you down, then I don't promise, but I might take you up. So that was my first, but as I said, it's history, and that's the thing, because now when we come to this place is like the mark of, this is a Palestinian place, and it's, no, this is like an Israeli archaeology today, it's Khan el-Hilu, the Israelis, it's an Israeli archaeology, and it's history, that's history. History is rewritten by the people who won the war. And when Israelis comes, they're like, this is Israeli archaeology, and not mentioning the Nakba because they won the war. So it's discovery, it's art, it's modern, it's And Palestinians come and say, this is Palestinians, but I remember what my fellow Palestinians did. So these places, the history, it's everything you can bury in the history for me. So this is what he told me. The second story about this place is we used to have the courage games of who will enter this place crawling, as I said, like tunnels. Because this place was the main meetings of, Lid is one of the biggest drug markets in the Middle East. So this used to be where people want to smoke, want to use needles, want to use these things. So it used to be who's the guy, the most courage guy that will go into this place crawling at 10 p.m. or whatever when there's no lights. And most of the time in Lid, there's no lights. Actually, there's no story because I've never done it. I was afraid. So I was the bitch in my friend. So, but the third one was according to the guy's stories, this is the place where everybody, all my friends lost their virginity in this specific place. Really, it's like this place where you go and everybody, and I really felt bad because I didn't, because everybody just went there and I didn't. And when I grew up, I've noticed there's a lot of lies about these things and nobody did that. And a lot of them became religious. And that's funny because they still don't admit that they lie. They rather carry the sin of having sex and not carry the sin of lying, because sexism and chauvinism is way more, being a man is way more important. But even when we go there, nowadays, especially nowadays, because a few years ago, they decided to clean the place. And now you can see it exactly like this. And the way the light comes from, do you see how, I don't know, maybe you waited for this certain hour, but when the light comes from here and it shows that it light the darkness, and that's what happened. They worked on it for the last 4 or 5 years, and it's really clean, and suddenly it's a place where Israel is somehow, the municipality of Lid is somehow proud of. And it's ours, but it's not ours. But it's mine as a Palestinian because I heard stories about it and I read about it. I wasn't part of the Nakba. I wasn't born yet. But still, I have my certain memories in this place, and my certain memories, and they are all in Arabic. There is no olive trees. There are no Palestinian flags. There is no PLO. There is nothing in it. There is no Arafat, there is nothing, there is just us Arabs playing in this place. So I have, but all of them are in Arabic, even though there is no patriotism or Palestinian themes in it, but it's all in Arabic. So nowadays, when I still go there and I see groups of Israelis talking about this place like an art and its mark, I feel my own Nakba. Not the 1948 Nakba, but my own Nakba, because this is my Palestinian memories. Unfortunately, my Palestinian memories is ripping ears and having sex and these things, but this is my place. And, you know, when I saw this place, I just showed it to my friends. I showed them, I asked them to admit if they did have sex or not, but they didn't. But as soon as I saw this photo, I was like, there is no way it's not in Lid. And I sent it to friends of mine to ask them, is it Lid? Is it not Lid? Then I noticed that it's Akka, right? And Akka is the twin city of Lid, because it's weird because Akka is also like the second city when it comes to drugs and poverty and these things. And it's weird that from all the photos I was attached to this one. And Akka is the same as Lid in a way. And one of my first Palestinian hip-hop shows was here. And one of the first Palestinian Akka, there's another group in Akka that started also here. So it's just weird that everything is connected. And it's weirder that a guy that I've never met in my life and lives thousands of miles away just captured great memories. And that's it. I liked it. Sorry for the... No, why sorry? You laughed. You enjoyed it. Shukran Ilko.
Thank you all for your readings of these images. I mean, in a way, that's the thing that I find most touching is when you... relate as the way in which you did, Tamar. You know, something comes alive in a way that I haven't been able to access. And for me also, I mean, that touches on something that's very important essential to me, really, that Aaron was talking about is this, for me, it's this also this idea of catharsis, like what does a portrait hold? It's an invitation, but the person also retains something for themselves that you're interested in about, you're interested in knowing about, but you aren't always able to access. And so when we speak about Munir's testimony, for instance, I mean, for me, those kinds of experiences are extremely touching, because you try to reach somebody on an emotive plane that, you know, transcends national boundaries and where you come from. And you kind of, if you're lucky, you strike a rapport, and perhaps the person, as in this case, felt comfortable to tell a story that had not really been told broadly since the time when he was a child and witnessed massacre and left his home. What I found so upsetting in what happened in America was this idea that I always imagined that this catharsis of having your testimony, I mean, in many of my projects I'm interested in testimony in the sense that maybe you don't heal something for that person's life. Maybe you don't change the situation drastically. I think that would be hubris to imagine you could. But perhaps there is some value in the idea of allowing a person that dignity, that space, to tell you what happened to them in their lives. And I found it so hurtful that, you know, people who were threatened by the idea of discussing these events of history would try and infer that this person's testimony had been concocted. That just completely took the rug out from under me, because I think that the most essential starting point has to be a position of empathy. And I know very little about this place after having spent the better part of 5 years here. But I do know with the greatest certainty that the only way to move ahead has to be with respect and dignity for other people and their stories, whether they be full of humor, but also those that are full of tragedy. And I think that's the one thing that I have learned most about, you know, about being here. So anyway, thank you for listening.